Welcome to another round of Drawing Board or Miro Board. Today, we talk brainstorms with UX designer Brian. Let's go. First question. You thought you'd see everyone's idea in the team brainstorm, but you've got a grand total of one. Drawing Board or Miro Board?
Drawing Board, right? Because in Miro, the team can add ideas now or later. And with Privacy Mode, we can keep them anonymous until they're good to share.
Correct. Next, you need the best way to explain your idea, but all you have is a few sticky notes. Drawing Board or Miro Board?
Drawing Board, because, you know, in Miro, I could record videos, add text, images, links, and digital sticky notes, of course, present my thoughts the way I want.
Right again! Now, you're looking for a past idea you thought was just genius. Only you could find... Oh, there it is! Drawing Board or...
Miro! All our finished and unfinished work lives in one place.
And he's won.
Join over 60 million people getting ideas noticed in Miro Brainstorms. Get your first three boards for free at Miro.com. That's M-I-R-O.com.
The Hard Shoulder with Kieran Cuddihy.
With Nissan.
On News Talk.
There's a big event happening tonight. It's another reason why we're here. A celebration of the Good Friday Agreement. 25 years, of course, we're coming up on that anniversary, the quarter century anniversary of the Good Friday Agreement. One of those people who will be in attendance is Gary Donegan, Father Gary Donegan. He was as well centrally involved in another event from the North's more recent history, 21 years ago, to be precise, the Holy Cross dispute, when loyalists blockaded Holy Cross Primary School, and Gary and Father Aidan Troy had to lead children through that blockade for months on end. And I know lots of you will be like me, you'll remember the images on the TV screens or the pictures in the paper and the vitriol directed by those protesters at not just Gary and Aidan, but at all those young kids as well. Listen, Gary, thanks a million for joining us here in our studio, our makeshift Boston studio here in the Langham Hotel. You're very welcome.
No, thanks very much. Yeah, it's great to be here.
For people maybe like myself who remember those images, and I can still picture them, from the front of the newspaper, but I can't quite remember exactly the build-up to it, the context, why this was happening. Remind us of those details. What was going on?
Well, basically, the demographics of the area meant that at one stage the school, the girls' school, would have been in an area that was mixed, if not predominantly Catholic. But as time changed and there was a burning out, kind of an ethnic cleansing of Catholics from that area, but the school still remained there. So it was in the centre of what would have been predominantly PUL, Protestant Unionist Loyalist area. But as we know, children in the main were sacrosanct during what we euphemistically refer to as the Troubles. So the school was there and was fine. But then one afternoon, these men appeared out of nowhere and were going to block the children from returning home. And thus began, it was on the 19th of June, my birthday, ironically. And I was in Dublin being trained by the Car Communications and working in media. And I lifted the Evening Herald and I saw a local councillor and I had to literally race back. So I didn't get to the cinema or my Eddie Rockets that night. And raced back into the midst of this. And for the next number of weeks, we tried to resolve it before the children would go back to school again in September. But on the 3rd of September, Father Aidan and Troy and I, as a sign of contradiction, basically stuck on our religious habits and decided we'd walk the children. Now, what happened was it shocked even hardened security force people, because there was basically we walked through a tunnel of people shouting vitriolic stuff, spitting, throwing things. I got hit with a piece of rebar, which is reinforced concrete in buildings, and it kind of shocked the world. And then it became the big media story. It was covered almost like 24/7.
And those men who turned up that first day, I mean, who were they? Why were they doing it? Was it a part of that burning out process? This was kind of the last stage in it, they felt. And how much support had they in that wider PUL community, as you describe it, do you think?
Well,
initially.
Yeah, well, at the time, it depended on who was there. It was initially that a guy was putting up a poster near the school, and it was alleged that he was intimidated by a taxi driver. The taxi driver said that he was attacked by the guy putting up the poster. But it was the fact that suddenly these 20 individuals came out of nowhere, and then there became that almost like Mexican standoff, as it were. And but by, you know, the next day there were hundreds, and then there were thousands, literally, of people involved in this. And over the summertime, obviously, we tried to calm everything down. We tried to get some sort of resolution, because our fear was this would be replicated right across the city, if not across the whole of the north, and that children would be blocked going from schools, you know, where it was into a nationalist area or into the PUL area. So, but by the 3rd of September, I think everybody was taken by surprise by literally the sheer number of people. Now, in order for the number of people to be there, they had to be bussed in, it had to be organised.
Yeah.
And it was. And so we ran a gauntlet, and basically at that time, and it was the old grey Land Rovers.
The old RUC Land Rovers,
yes, yeah. And we had to walk between them, and you're kind of, you know, caught in between this, so you couldn't actually avoid it. And it captured the imagination of the world, because by the following day, all the media were there, CNN, Fox News, Al Jazeera, everybody was there with the big mushroom vans. And in fact, that's how I found out about 9/11. On the third day, which was the 6th of September, a blast bomb was fired. And that was the day that I thought, we're going to lose someone here. Mm. And it was a terrifying experience for everybody. Children running, parents running, children being separated. And I actually saw a piece of footage. And you know the way you don't recognize your own voice? Mm. And I sounded a great culture, but I was trying to evacuate people off the road. And I remember in the grounds, the children in the grounds, and literally some of them were physically shaking. And Anne Tanney was the principal of the school at the time, and the teachers, now they were phenomenal. They would bring the children in, and they tried to calm them down, and they tried. And then we had to walk back again. Even after that, we had to walk back down again with the parents, with the grandparents, and the guardians of the children. Mm. And it was just, it was unbelievable. And I suppose another significant moment was 9/11, where I was walking down, and I'd just been handed a death threat, and the police, it's ironic, there's different levels of threats. But they actually handed me one which is called critical, which means that you're going to be taken out, as it were. And so I was in a bit of another world, because at that stage that was the first of many that I'd ever received. But I this was like the first time. And so I was walking down, and the next thing, I thought I could get shot here, and they're watching Bruce Willis in Braveheart, or the one of these movies, Die Hard, because all the vans had these blankets of TV screens, and I could see these two towers, and I thought it was Die Hard the movie, until this man ran up to me and he said, "All right, World War III has broken out," and I looked at him and I said, "What do you mean?" And he said, "The Pentagon has just been bombed," and that was my first knowledge of 9/11, yeah. Because when you're the news, you don't see the news, as it were. And they were all watching this. And the scary thing was, the following day, nothing. All the vans were gone. And that actually was the probably the most terrifying day, because we didn't have the cover even of the media. And as we walked through, and I remember them shouting, "If you like priest funerals, clap your hands. If you like priest funerals, clap your hands," like a chant and a football chant. Mm. And I thought they were talking about Father Aidan and I, but actually it was Father Michael Judge, who was the first recognised victim of 9/11. He was the chaplain to the fire department. And there's this iconic picture of this older man being carried out, covered in dust and rubble. And the next thing, they were taunting us actually about that. So ironically, then I became very friendly with fire department and NYPD officers. And Father Michael Judge is the first recognised victim. And everybody thought he died in the rubble, but actually it was a glancing blow of the hand of one of the jumpers that actually hit him falling from the building. And because I got a private tour by the fire department to the new museum.
Yeah.
And by the policeman that was actually the first responder. So so this the vitriolic nature of it was scary.
It, you know, you mentioned all those vans as well that were there up until 9/11, and it strikes me there must have been a resonance for people, because we're broadcasting from the States, for people with images they had seen 30 years previously here, schools integration. Mm-hmm. And we can all imagine those pictures as well in our mind's eye of those African-American kids going into school and these white parents or fellow students screaming abuse at them. It was very much like that.
Yeah, and actually they went up a mural on one of the walls in Ardoyne, at the famous Ardoyne shops. And actually it was comparing Arkansas and Ardoyne, and there was images of the black children not being allowed to go to school or to be segregated. And it did capture the imagination. Now, to balance it out, there were people, because ironically, I had walked with an empty cross with the minister from the Church of Ireland Church right along the same road to the Church of Emmanuel. And I had walked with him on Good Friday, and we'd walked across from an empty cross from Holy Cross Church up to the Church of Emmanuel with parishioners on both sides.
Yeah.
And we all then shared the hot cross buns and a bit of crack in the church. Some of those people were horrified by what was going on, and they were saying, "Not in our name." But they too were trapped, and some of them said, "Father, don't bend the knee. What you're doing is incredibly brave, but we're afraid, and sometimes we have to stand out and look like as if we're part of the protest, because we're living in the midst of it."
Yeah.
So it wasn't just a black and white situation, as none of the Troubles was.
And when we mentioned the RUC, how much protection and everything did they was there any criticism of the level of protection that they offered yourselves and the fellow students? Because, of course, you know, they formed part of this sectarian tapestry in a lot of people's minds.
Yeah, well, one of the things was that, you know, they were alongside you with the big plastic shields, the baton shields, and some of the stuff was kind of coming over the top, and they were actually doing that. What the biggest criticism was that the British Army there as well, that when we were walking through the gauntlet, when the gates would open in the morning between two armoured vehicles, that the guns were facing the children and the parents, not the protagonists. And it's something that we highlighted at the time. Many of them were horrified and would spoken to you personally about them. I remember one policeman who, it was the last thing he was involved in, he emigrated to Australia after that, and he said, had he not have been already doing that, this was the last straw, because it was the fact that it was children that horrified so many people.
How was it resolved in the end?
Not many people remember this, But in fact, actually, there was lots and lots of negotiations. And so basically, it has never been concluded. It is the longest suspension of anything, 21 years.
So, it's like this, like the Korean War, that they're still technically at war.
That's it. And basically, I think after a while, people realized it was a political own goal. And I think that everybody and sundry thought, how can we? So the conclusion was to put it in suspension. And there have been little incidents down the last 21 years, but in the main, it has just remained in that way.
And, you know, when that happens, then the rest of us kind of go back to our lives and whatever else happens to be in the news agenda. As you say, all those CNN trucks, they get busy with post-9/11 and the post-9/11 world that we all find ourselves living in. But for yourselves and Father Troy and for the children, I mean, there must be a legacy.
Oh, there's I mean, why am I here? I mean, I was a itinerant preacher. I was actually asked to go to Belfast. It was not by choice. And then suddenly we gained so much credibility, Aidan and I, with society, with people, because at the end of the day, if you're willing to put your life on the line, which we were, the reality is we got a foot into the situation. So then I began to get involved in negotiations, involved in direct peace work, confiscating and decommissioning weapons, drugs, issues. Then began working with the governments and then became a conduit and various different things. So it gave a foothold into the situation for us. For the children, many of them went into serious counselling, and some of the parents. I did the funeral of two of the mothers. Ironically, in one case, the daughter actually did really well and got her degree and moved on in life, but the mother couldn't live with it, and she ended up with serious alcohol issues and died a young woman. And because when Aidan actually officiated at her wedding, her and her husband, they looked like something out of Hollywood. And when I went then to do the funeral, when I looked in the coffin, it was like an old woman. And the PTSD is something that I was diagnosed with it 10 years ago. I got hit with water cannon during rioting, and I experienced, as a result of my work, many suicides, murders. And it was only when I came away, my order pulled me, the Passionist pulled me out of Ardoyne. I was the rector and parish priest at the time. And I did a sabbatical here in the States in the School of Applied Theology in Berkeley. But I was in a place called Bear Creek doing this beautiful retreat. And I'd been with Martin McGuinness and Peter Robinson, open, ironically, a suicide prevention centre. And the first night that I was away, no phones, no nothing, suddenly I woke up and I was in suds, like what you see in the movies. I didn't think that could actually happen in real life. Mm. And I was in a neonatal unit in my mind, and I was floating above the cots. And in the first cot was my little nephew, baby Michael, who died 26 years ago. But in the next cot, it was a baby's body, but it was the head of someone who had burnt himself alive in suicide. The next cot was the first murder that I was called out to, where it was the body of the child but the head of the man who'd been shot at close range, and I had to anoint, because you go skin to skin, I'd anoint his tummy because his head was destroyed, and right along all these kind of horrific scenes. So that was the first time that I sought help, yeah. And I was in the right place in the States, and I've suffered from a form of PTSD. In fact, I dealt with a suicide recently in our grounds, and that night I could see the girl, yeah. because I was left with her hanging there, and her phone kept ringing, and that started to trigger it off again. But I now know what to do and how to get the help. But I have dealt with many of the parents and the children all these years later. And ironically, I did the wedding of one of the girls not that long ago.
Oh, lovely.
Last year.
Yeah.
And one of the things was, from the States, they were sent these therapy dolls.
Yeah.
And they still have them, you know, 21 years later. And when the bride was coming up the aisle, her therapy doll was sitting in the front seat beside the bridesmaid. So I said at the wedding, I said, 21 years ago, one of the proudest things I ever did in my life was walk you to school. And I said, and I feel very proud to see you walk up the aisle to be married. But Aidan has been back with me in Ardoyne at the minute. He's on a sabbatical, and we have a bond that's quite unique, and he's been brilliant because he's been helping covering, including for me to come out here. So it was a unique situation, and it left a mark on our lives.
Mm. Well, listen, we really appreciate you sharing the story, the experience of it, the memories, the legacies of it, the negative legacies. But also, I think it's a nice story as well to wrap things up on, that marriage as well, that you walked the girl to school and were there to watch her walking up the aisle as well. Listen, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thanks a million for joining us.
Oh, great to see you. God bless. Thank you.
The Hard Shoulder with Kieran Cuddihy.
With Nissan.
Weekdays from 4 on News Talk.